Wonderful. So, hey, welcome back, because it is the second one of this wonderful series by the Digital Freedom Fund, Reigning in Big Tech, How Competition Law Can Help Protect Digital Rights. And I'm really super happy today that we have had, after a flamboyant start last week, that we're going to go deeper into the depths of competition law and understand more about this, because yes, it is all about, well, we will see in a second, big tech, obviously, and competition law. So a warm welcome again. I'm AC Coppens of the Catalyst, a boutique agency based in Berlin, working on science, innovation, and new technologies, how they shape the creative part of society, but also the work and the philosophical and political aspects. And this is why we were kindly asked by the Digital Freedom Fund to host this brand new series. Well, not so brand new because it is the second one, but we want to explore together how we can make better use of competition law framework to protect digital rights. Indeed, there is a broader movement built around the awareness of increasing inequality and economic concentration, which has contributing to popularize the idea that competition law and policy may have a role to play. And that's why we have a debate around the goals, the purposes, how it works. And this is more than legit. And this is why we want to have a look, especially because of its increasing relevance in the digital concentration times. And digital concentration, talking about concentration, I'm not only talking about the economy and the markets, but also our own concentration on devices. So this speaker series will approach different issues like why competition law can be relevant to users of digital devices, what is the recent German ruling on Facebook, what does it mean, maybe the discussion in the EU around the topic, what can be learned from previous cases, which future cases are coming up also. So much more, and everything which is relating to curtailing platform power and make this know-how accessible is the goal of this series. So we will go beyond the expert spheres. And as I was saying last week already, I'm not an expert. And that's actually maybe why I'm here, to ask questions where you might also have answers already, but we want to make it clear for everyone. And remember later for the chat, especially those who are like me, maybe not lawyers, who would like to ask questions, there are no stupid questions here. So now a couple of housekeeping rules very quickly. Make sure please that you are muted, that your camera is off for now. Maybe you will have it on later on in case you want to ask a question. So we encourage you to write your questions in the chat. And here the team of the Digital Freedom Fund will pick the questions that will be asked later on. And then I will call your names and ask you, do you want to be on camera maybe? So precise in your question, if you want to be live, please just write live. And then I will say, oh, you want to be on camera, let's go. And then we will have the question to make this a little bit more, let's say, human, so to speak. And also to make things more human, you can use the reaction buttons. You see them down to your menu next to the pause, stop, and the share screen and the leave. Don't leave, don't touch the leave button. Just go to the reaction. There is a little plus, and then you can, you know, like, say hello, like, and whatever that is. Make yourself a scene. For those who have the gallery view, you can see the reaction of the audience that way, which is a nice way. And I think that's it. So you can write your questions in the chat whenever. So that's, you know, when you feel something, because we're going to go on. It is a very substantial discussion we will have. So we will go on. So don't forget your question. Put it in the chat and then we will get back to it in the Q&A section, which is then at the end of the conversation I will have with our guest today. Yes, and our guest today for this wonderful discussion, how competition law can help protect digital rights, reigning in big tech. Well, don't need to tell you, Google, Apple, Facebook, Amazon, Microsoft, they wield unprecedented power. And many people fear, not only the lawyers, that they control people's most personal data, distort democracy, hamper innovation, and so forth. And around the world, a lot of competition authorities are investigating this. So in this discussion, we want to see what happened with big tech. How do tech giants typically justify their conduct in the face of such criticism and fears? And ultimately, if competition law is failing us right now, or should it play a new role, more effective, possibly in the digital economy specifically? And our guest today, I'm really enthused to have him with us. I must say, the speakers invited in this row is fantastic, fantastic quality and expertise we're going to share together here. Dr. Konstantinos Stylianou, he's a professor in competition law and regulation, and he's a deputy director of the Center for Business Law and Practice at the University of Leeds School of Law. He has a different areas of focus, of course, law and policy of digital markets, blockchain and communications networks. And he has a specific expertise also in cryptocurrencies, telecommunications, regulations and internet. So just perfect for us. He has worked on numerous projects funded by the European Union, the Swedish Competition Authority, but also Google, Facebook, the Thailand's National Broadcasting and Telecommunications Commission. He has been a member of the Lawmaking Commission for the Modernization of Competition Law in Greece. It was this year. And he has degrees of universities of Pennsylvania, Harvard University. He has been a visiting scholar at Oxford University. So again, like our speakers last week, a fantastic track record. So I'm enthused, and I would say, Konstantinos, let's go into this discussion. I would like to structure it in three parts. First, we will have some basic stuff around tech giants and competition law. And then we will go deeper into abuse of dominance in the digital markets. And then we will broaden the discussion to emerging digital markets and the future of competition law. So let's start bold, Konstantinos, with a bold question. Is bold or is big bad? It is a popular observation when it comes to online or digital platform that big is bad. Is big bad? And how do they defend their size? And tell us more about this, please.
Sure. Thank you, AC. We did start bold. The introduction that you gave me was quite bold. I've never been described as fantastic, but I'll take it. Thank you for organizing this. Thank you for putting it together. This is a fantastic event series. I'm really happy to be here. Really happy to find out more about what the Digital Freedom Fund is doing. So again, very much appreciated. And thank you to everyone else who is joining us today. I'll try to keep things easily accessible and understandable, but at the same time, I'm very much open to questions. So if anything remains unclear, more than happy to elaborate on it further. No.
Well, let me interrupt you very quickly also, because we have been preparing sources for you. So look at the chat. There are some links that will be pushed into the chat. And Melissa, who was here a second ago from my team, will be also animating this chat while pushing the sources that Konstantinos and the Digital Freedom Fund have been preparing for you. Sorry to interrupt you, Konstantinos, but I wanted them to know it's really rich, immersive experience.
Not a problem. Great. Again, thank you. So to your question, is big bad, which is a question that has been coming up quite frequently over the past couple of years. I mean, traditionally, but now it's very much in the foreground. And regardless of the answer to that competition authorities might give to that, it's interesting to see what the tech giants themselves say about their own size and whether it's bad. I mean, spoiler alert, they say it's not bad, but it's interesting to see what are the arguments behind it. So let me just start by saying what in competition law is pretty much like a very, very fundamental axiom, which answers the question precisely because it exactly says big is not bad. We don't have a problem with bigness. It's not the size itself that matters to us. What we are concerned with is rather what we think size stands for. And what size usually stands for is market power. And the concern is what bigness enables companies to do. So this is why we so much focus on the tech giants. We are concerned that because of their size and how this is projected more generally in market power, we are concerned at how they might, we're not definitely saying that they do, but they might abuse that, that power. There is a very interesting quote from a very famous US antitrust case that dates back to the 1940s. It's called Alcoa. And there, the presiding judge said that the successful, and I quote, "the successful competitor, having been urged to compete, must not be turned upon when he wins." So the idea behind it is that if you become big and you deserve it, the fact that you're big per se is not a problem. So why are we concerned? We are concerned because, as I said, being big is associated with everything that is bad about monopolies. And there is a long history of the things that we find are bad with monopolies. And the three main things with that are bad with monopolies, we say, are higher prices, lower output, less innovation. But the comeback of tech giants is that we're nowhere close to that. Like, you can call us monopolists as much as you want, but none of the traditional harms that we assign to monopoly apply to us. And they take them one by one, and they can essentially they essentially provide data to show that we're the good guys. We don't do any of the harmful effects of monopoly. Now, I'll demonstrate this very, very quickly if I can, if I manage to share my my screen. So, starting from prices, the quite obvious difference is that our products are free. Now, of course, we know that their products are not free, but even if they are not completely free, the amount that we are getting for the price that we pay, and the price might come in different forms, including, for example, paying with our personal data, which is a common comeback, is very, very low. So we're not really jacking up any prices. Instead, we're offering a lot of products for free. So there is that. So the first downside of monopolies, we don't do that. Do we reduce output? And the answer is again, no, we don't reduce output. If anything, people now have more access than ever before to more products. And if you look, for example, let's take Apple and Google, the traditional monopolists. If you look at the mobile phone shipments over the last decade or so, you'll see that more and more people have access to mobile phones. And if you look, for example, at the numbers, the number of apps that are being downloaded, if we say that apps is another relevant product in this whole ecosystem, we can again see that the output, in the sense of like how much of something is consumed, produced and consumed, is not decreasing. So output is also doing fine. So how about reductive innovation? And the thing is also, they say, on their side, because if we have a look at what are the most innovative companies measured by the amount of R&D they spend, the amount of money they spend in research and development, and I intentionally picked Wikipedia because it's supposed to be relatively neutral, you'll see that Amazon, Google, Microsoft, Intel, Apple, and a little further down, Facebook, they're all there. They are spending insane amounts of money on research and innovation, which in turn is translated into new products and innovation and so on. And again, if one said, one were to argue that the reason why they can spend so much money is because they have a massive amount of revenue, even if we look at it as a percentage of revenue, if you look at how much the technology companies together with media and telco spend, they fare relatively high in terms of which industries spend more money in R&D per revenue. The last thing I want to mention before I close is big bad and their defenses argument is that recently a lot has been said about the so-called killer acquisitions or the fact of rising concentration and how they harm innovation by buying up small startups and small competitors before they have a chance to become real threats. And Facebook was grilled over this point a few months ago when the House of Commons the House in the United States of Representatives had a deposition, and they shared extracts of what Facebook said about the potential for Instagram to become a competitor, and they snapped it up pretty quickly before it had a chance to do so. So the concern is that less and less money goes into startups, fewer startups can compete, and so on. But again, they point to very healthy numbers in terms of how the community is doing. And this chart combines a lot of information about startups, including how much money is poured into startups from venture capitals. It's the blue bars. And as you can see, from, say, 2013 to 2020, it has been increasing, and the number of startup firms is also either increasing or slightly decreasing, but not to the extent that they attributed to large firms. So all in all, when we ask them, is big bad? Their answer is, not only is it not bad, it actually turns out to be very much in the favor of consumers.
This is interesting because if consumer welfare is the, let's say, ultimate objective of competition law, is it actually? You have to tell me. But how can then tech giants claim they protect it when they drive out competitors from the market?
Right. Okay. So this is interesting because, I mean, in a way, it goes to the very heart of what competition law is supposed to do. And you ask 10 people, you're going to get 11 opinions on that. And
you mean roughly, lawyers?
And especially with lawyers, you're going to get 100. but you ask two people, representative people from the two sides of the Atlantic, let's say the European Union and the US as the biggest and the most influential jurisdictions in the world in terms of antitrust and competition law enforcement. And you'll get two slightly different answers. And the European Union is going to tell you, we protect the process of competition. And the US is going to tell you, we protect consumers. And of the two, it's pretty evident to anyone who follows competition law enforcement that the European Union has been a lot more active. So it seems like protecting the process of competition needs a little more support and a little more enforcement than protecting consumers, because as we just said, turns out that all these tech giants, everything they do is in the benefit of consumers. But the reason why the European Union has this different stance is precisely because of a faith that through the process, we will get the best deal. Protect the process of competition, allow competition to do its job, and ultimately, everything else will follow. We will get the lower prices. We will get the higher output. We will get more innovation. But all of that is subject to ensuring that competition actually works. Now, in the US, they see it slightly different, and they say, as long as the outcome that I care about is fine, then I'm good. I don't particularly care about how we get there. Now, there is some merit in that, in the sense that it's a little tricky to say that we protect competition for the sake of competition. And the reason for that is that we don't exactly know what we are protecting, and we don't know when to stop. So if someone told you, would you rather have only one company that, however, provides fantastic products, or have two competing companies that, because they don't reach a certain size that allows them to take full advantage of, say, economies of scale, or raise enough capital to make the necessary investments, they seem to be providing subpar products? And it's a very difficult answer to give, whether the trust in the process will actually result in what we want, or whether we should focus directly on the outcome. And this is an impossible question to answer, to be honest.
Good. Okay. That's a lawyer answer. That's for sure. But in any case, let's dig now further in our second step into abuse of dominance in the digital market. So for those of us who are new to the subject, could you please maybe redefine abuse of dominance and maybe illustrate with a couple of examples?
Sure. So abuse of dominance is what we call in Europe is the European equivalent of what they call in the US monopolization.
Okay.
So abuse of dominance or monopolization basically means that a company that has a dominant position in the market, so a very large market power, essentially, does not engage in what the European Union calls normal competition, right? Which is kind of like tautological, because how do you define something with something else that itself needs definition? So what is normal competition? And to cut the long story short, because this is not a competition law module, the idea is that as long as you engage in competition on the merits, as long as what you do is based on business acumen rather than on exploiting competitors or consumers in the market or driving them out of the market, so as long as it's on the merits, as long as it's efficient, as long as it promotes progress and innovation and so on, then it's good. Once you step away, and the farther away you are from that, it might be abusive.
Mm-hmm. And do you believe that these existing competition law frames around abuse of dominance actually are completely applicable to digital markets? I mean, we had that question last week with Niamh Dunn, where we were talking about this, like, oh, can we apply this actually in the same way? Oh, no, it doesn't work exactly the same way. So what is your take on that one? Do you believe that it is applying neatly to digital markets?
Okay, so a good question. And I think the answer to that is kind of like always yes, but needs improvement. And I say yes because the structure of how we approach competition laws and enforcement is doing all right. What do? We define markets first to set the scope of the investigation, and then we measure market power, and then we try to see if they abuse the market power. And this kind of like analytical framework in itself, it's not bad. Now, of course, along every step of those of this framework, how do you define the market in digital markets? How do you measure market power? How can you tell with certainty what is abusive and what is not? Now, all of those elements need a little bit of fine tuning, and a lot has been written on it. And I don't want to go into too much detail in terms of like how exactly we can improve that kind of like structural framework, because I think there is something a little more interesting in that framework. And that part is that even if we could fine-tune it to make it perfectly applicable in digital markets, the same way that it was, let's say, more applicable or more suited 50 or 100 years ago when the first competition laws emerged. And so let's say that when they were enacted, they were in better touch with the industry. There are still some problems that we need to work on. And I think that a lot of competition authorities are in the right direction, but this is what we should be focusing on. And one of them is that competition law enforcement takes an awful lot of time. Most of the cases that hit the headlines, like the Google search case and the Google Android case, and now the case in the United States against Google, and there have been other cases in the past, most of them from beginning to end, so from the moment that the investigation will begin to the moment that the case will become final, they might take up like more than a decade. Now imagine in regular markets, if a decade is a long time, imagine how digital markets looked back in say 2009. So it's an insane amount of time to allow to pass between the identification of the problem and the remedies. The second problem is the remedies. It's like in most cases, remedies in competition law used to be, or at least many of them used to be, a fine. Now, the problem with companies like Google and Apple, when you're a trillion dollar company, a fine in the range of $5 billion is nothing. I remember I was checking Google's market capitalization when the Google shopping case came out, and the market share when the case outcome was announced dipped maybe 3% on that day. It was up by 6% by the end of the week. So it does nothing to their finances. It does nothing to their reputation. It's very, very hard to basically discipline companies like that with fines, no matter how big they are. Mm-hmm. And the last thing is that once these decisions come out, I just wanted to also mention that because of this, a lot of authorities now gravitate towards behavioral remedies, which is not here's a fine that you need to pay, but rather you need to change your behavior in the market. Now, the problem with that, which brings me to my third point, is that quite often this is very vague. They say in the decision, you need to stop this conduct, but they don't say how. They don't say what exactly you're supposed to do. And so the way these companies implement it is not necessarily compliant. And unless the competition authorities then follow up and say you didn't fully comply, then and impose further financial sanctions and so on, then this is kind of like a dead end. So the Google Android case and the Google shopping cases both have been very heavily criticized because the Google shopping case, the comparison shopping websites, they said we had 1% more traffic after the decision. That's nothing. The decision did nothing to us. So basically it was useless. Mm-hmm. And so it's very difficult to design appropriate remedies and to implement them and follow up with them.
Okay, so basically it means we need to see maybe if we do more for the digital market, if we have more specific answers for the digital market. And so, because basically if existing frameworks are not enough for the digital markets, because they do not fit exactly, and then it takes time and there will be a lot of questions, as you were saying, how can they be amended, and what is done for this currently? And why do tech giants, for example, fall through the cracks of competition enforcement, so to speak? I mean, this is actually revolting. I'm working in the tech thing, and I'm thinking like normally everything is so fast, and you know, like, and the tech people are trying also to react fast and to take some opportunities, right? So if the competition law enforcement is not enough, they will find the crack, right?
Right. No, that's a great point. And all of the ways that we have devised so far, how exactly to fine tune what is a market definition, how to move from financial sanctions to behavioral remedies, how to speed up the process through perhaps greater use of interim measures. We don't have to wait all 10 years. Let's impose interim measures first and then see what happens. So all of these are sort of like incremental solutions. But if you're asking me, I think what has become abundantly clear in the last decade is that, let me back up one step. We used to say that competition law is a surgical tool, meaning that the reason why we use competition law is when we find that a single company has done something wrong, we go after that company, we tell it to stop that particular behavior. That's all great. But what happens when all the companies in a certain market behave in a bad way? What happens when we have a problem with Apple, Facebook, Google, Amazon, Intel, Tesla, whatever other company you want to put in the digital markets basket? Now that means that it's not the company that is a problem, It's the market that is a problem. And when we move from a company problem to a market-wide problem, then we need to move to something that is a little more regulatory in nature. Because regulation, by definition, is not a surgical tool, is a general applicability tool. It says, here's the rule, everyone needs to follow it. And so one thing that, and I am sharing one of my favorite cartoons on that in the chat. So if you're asking me, one of the things that we should be doing is use competition law not as a tool that comes into play against one particular company after something has happened, but rather as a tool that can devise rules that we can use before we get to a situation where market has already been severely abused over a long period of time. Mm-hmm. And so the idea is that we need to be using more regulation rather than just exposed competition. Now, this particular cartoon, let me just close with that, is a little more insightful than it appears at first glance, because in the sadomasochistic relationship between the dominatrix and what clearly is Mark Zuckerberg, there is a masochistic part, which is that the person invites regulation. They welcome regulation. And this is interesting because even though traditionally we say that companies don't want regulation, sometimes they do. And you know, when they do want it, they know that they do want it when, if they are regulated and they do what the regulators say, then they think that antitrust laws will no longer apply to them because we are doing what the regulator asks us to do. What more do you want? Mm-hmm. So sometimes they use regulation, and if they lobby well enough and hard enough, they can do that. They use regulation as a way to get out of the difficult position by say, regulate us, we'll do what you ask us to do. It's of course usually light touch or very difficult to implement. And then they'll say, this is a regulated market. We don't really have that much room for freedom anymore. We're doing what you told us, so get off our back. So this is why the brilliance in this cartoon, it's the fact that yes, we need more regulation rather than just antitrust, but also sometimes they can even manipulate that. It's quite interesting.
It's super interesting. We have to invite some psychologists on top of this now, not only the lawyers. But okay, let us go into the more futuristic part of our discussion now, and let us see what's happening at the emerging digital market, because a lot of things, and you were saying it's a lot about the tech giants, which is happening right now. They are concentrating a lot about this. Are actually competition law and policy discussions too focused on the GAFAM, the Google, the Apple, and et cetera, et cetera? Are there maybe new emerging digital markets in smaller sectors appearing, startups and et cetera, where the anti-competitive harms are much stronger, or even more problematic, and we skip it because we're too focused on the GAFAM?
The answer that I would give is probably no. One thing that is clear, and it became very clear to me when I was working at the lawmaking commission earlier this year, is that competition authorities have very limited resources, so they do need to prioritize which cases they pick. And the thing is that if anything, these tech giants, they seem to affect their life and intermediate everything we do more and more compared to, say, 5 or 10 years ago. So I'd say that to the extent that they seem to be very relevant, even more so relevant now than before in our everyday life, the focus is not unwarranted. Mm-hmm. What is interesting, however, is that instead of moving away the focus from certain companies, I think what authorities need to anticipate and what competition law needs to anticipate is emerging technologies and markets rather than players. And what what I find quite interesting is that now a lot of those big companies are becoming entrants into what seems to be the next big frontier, which is financial technology markets. So obviously all of us is familiar with online banking, which is offered by traditional banks. What we are seeing, and we are seeing it all the more so after the popularity explosion of blockchain and Bitcoin and all of that in the past 10 years, is that finance and financial products and services is becoming a lot more decentralized. It used to be the prerogative of banks. It's becoming now the prerogative of less regulated actors or even grassroots movements like Bitcoin. And so my understanding is that Google and Apple and all of those companies are not going to go away. If anything, they do want a share of that market, and they will enter those markets, and they will use their power to make sure that they become successful in those markets. But for authorities to be able to be proactive, what they need to do is understand those new markets first. And what strikes me as quite interesting in, say, blockchain is that it's like anyone who is familiar with either blockchain or with competition authority, with competition law, will have heard this a million times. We keep saying blockchain is so new, blockchain is so revolutionary. Well, it is and it isn't. But in when it comes to competition law, it does change a couple of things. For one thing, you know, we keep saying Facebook did this, Amazon did that. But when we say Bitcoin did this, who is Bitcoin? So it's quite difficult to say who's behind all these new market forces. Who do we go after? Are these even economic actors that competition law generally is concerned with? Or are they amateurish activities that just happen to have an impact on the market? And even if we pass that hurdle, we're stuck with other things like, again, as we mentioned, market power, super central concept in competition law. But what is market power in crypto assets and crypto coins like Bitcoin and stuff? Does Bitcoin have market power? By market capitalization, sure, compared to which other assets? If we compare it towards like the dollar, then no. If we compare it towards other crypto assets, then yes. But are these really substitutes? So in order to be able to answer all of those questions, they need to familiarize themselves with the market. And as you can see, it's not like these giants are moving away from those markets. Facebook was keen to enter it, and that's why they created Libra. And right. I remember I was at the OECD conference a year ago when the Minister for Finance in France, without any pre-announcement or anything, he took up the stage and said, in its current form, there is no way we are going to allow Libra to run on the market. And just like that, the whole Libra vision collapsed. And now, I mean, it's not like they abandoned it, but they significantly changed what it is. But one of the concerns is that this is going to be in competition with market forces that we've never before seen, like central banks.
Mm-hmm. I'm French, so I'm not going to go into this minister thing into it. But yeah, exactly. And especially because we have to do with decentralized protocols to give actually the power to different actors on the market, which sounds to be good, right? It makes it still much more complex. And I think you made this point very clear. So this is the future, definitely, and this is going to happen. So I wonder, of course, how long will it take? But I think that we have a couple of questions coming up. And to be honest, I don't know where to start with, because it's really great. I see two questions here directly in the chat of Joanna Bryson. Is the issue here the fact that there are so few of them?
In the time when I typed it, I thought maybe people would respond when I typed it at the other audience. Yeah, it was exactly when you made this comment, which I thought was really interesting. In fact, I almost tweeted it, but I was too interested. when you were commenting that that this isn't the time for a surgical strike because there's too many, it's more than one company. It's all the companies, but all the companies are like six. Mm-hmm. So I have two questions about that observation. One is when there's only six companies, they are, of course, able to coordinate and collude. We already know that Apple and Google did that with respect to non-poaching and things like that. So the question is this, have we created, and it's not, I don't think it's entirely their fault. It's, I think it's the nature of the digital, unless you do the great firewall of China, that you do have the, you know, this consolidation. But have we created a situation where there's like six powers, and then is it maybe a little bit more like utilities, and that we have to figure out how to handle the fact that you, that them as a sector, not just them as individuals. And so that's part of where I was going there. And then the other part I tried to go to is, I loved the question that the host was asking about the rest of the companies. There's some great companies out there that are maybe even choosing not to have this kind of market cap strategy. And so the question is there a way that we can empower the rest of the sector? And if we did, would that somehow reduce the amount of damage that the top of the sector is creating?
Right. Okay. Fantastic questions, both. And I'm kind of like torn between playing devil's advocate here.
Yes, do it. Do it.
All right.
You could be both the devil and the angel and talk to yourself.
Okay. I'll be the schizophrenic one. Let me start by saying the quite obvious grammatical interpretation. Six by definition is not a monopoly. And there are markets that we haven't really touched very much, or at least they haven't attracted that much scrutiny, that were dominated by even fewer players. If you look at Intel and AMD microprocessors, for many years until like late 2009, we weren't particularly concerned in that market. Coca-Cola and Pepsi, Boeing and Airbus, there are markets that, because of whatever characteristics that they have, they tend to concentrate around a small number of companies. This, someone could say, might be not because they are abusing their power or because they are colluding, but it might be the nature of the market. There is a very interesting debate going on about the rising concentration across the board, not just the high-tech markets, all markets. There have been a couple of like very influential papers that have been published over the last couple of years that prove that concentration is rising, particularly in the US. And one of the ways they measure it is by looking at the markup rates. So how much profit are you making? And this sounds very alarming. But if you look closer to the data, one way to undermine this is to say the data is wrong, and there are lots of other studies that prove quite the opposite. And one of the ones, one that I could share, or if you want to look it up, was issued actually by the European Central Bank on concentration rates, and it debunks several myths around it. And I'm mentioning it because it's by the European Central Bank, so it has the veneer of neutrality in a way. But what I was getting at is that the fact that they have higher margins doesn't necessarily mean that there's something wrong to be concerned with. It might mean that they're just becoming more productive. Having higher profits means perhaps that you're reducing your own costs rather than jacking up the price. And it's very difficult to prove which one is the determining factor. So let me just say that six might not be a terrible number. Follow on point on the other thing that you said. Should we be treating them as utilities? Again, by definition, utility regulation was always concerned when the utility was a monopoly, or when in the very early stages of liberalization of the market, when we thought that it's very difficult to go from one to two, it's less difficult to go from two to three, even less difficult to go from three and four and so on. Now, the utilities market still remain highly concentrated, and it's been like about 30 years now that the telecom market, for example, has been liberalized, and you still see that in most countries, we only have like, say, three cell phone players. Why? Because again, the nature of the market might be such that only a certain number of players is allowed in the market. They might be profitable. However, and let me just say this, and then I see that you want to say something, but I'll leave it to the prerogative of AC as the moderator if they want to follow on. But let me just say this. Part of the regulation that I'm talking about is exactly on the last thing that you mentioned, which is, should we be finding ways to encourage startup creation? And the answer is yes. And let me go even farther. Black Friday is coming up. We should be encouraging ways to empower consumers. We seem to present the antitrust wars as between the government and tech giants, and consumers are there just to be the winners of this war if it's done properly, whereas we can actively take part. Don't shop from Amazon if you don't want to. Like, pay one more pound per product, or wait one more day. You don't have to get your product tomorrow. Or don't have a Facebook profile if you're so concerned with the data. But like, consumers need to do their part in this whole debate. And part of what competition authorities can do is educate them and ask them to be part of the solution rather than just present them as victims, the same way that companies present them as victims when they're regulated or when competition enforcement turns against them.
Very good. Yeah, there is indeed a note, not of Joanna, but of Elena Malikova in the chat. It is not a question, it's just a comment. I can read it very quickly. Your references relate to physical goods company that benefit from efficiencies in the tangible production facilities. So bigger can mean more efficient. Digital economy is less cost driven. We could relate to this. I think I would rather leave this because I have another question, if I may, which is building on Joanna's questions, which is about this surgical tool, because you explained a little bit earlier, we need more regulation rather than the surgical tool of competition law to deal with market-wide problems. So what kind of regulatory framework can be actually leveraged? What kind of regulation comes actually to your mind actually for to deal with these market-wide big tech problems?
Okay. So both the comment and the question, very, very fair. To the comment, I can just very quickly say that there are a lot of efficiencies that are associated with digital markets as well. It doesn't have to be a physical product. And one of the interesting things that transpired from the Google Android case, and one of the arguments, obviously, that Google advanced was that the fact that Google exercises such pervasive control over the whole Android ecosystem, similar to what Apple is doing, is because it wants to enhance the user experience. The fact that it controls the security aspects, the integration between different apps, the smooth updates, keeping out viruses and even the marketing and the arrangement and helping phone manufacturers to know what to do with Android, all of those efficiencies were basically grounded on the fact that Google has the power to effectuate them. So what I would say is that always take it with a pinch of salt, but there are efficiencies in digital markets as well. Now, in terms of regulation, a very good point. I think we almost have the answer already. The European Union is, after 10 years of, well, 6 years, not 10 years, but like after 6 or 7 years, is finally unveiling the Digital Services Act, which a part of which is two new mechanisms to enhance competition in the market. And one of them is a kind of like a very regulatory tool by nature, which is it gives the right to competition authorities to run market investigations, so whole market-wide investigations, and if they perceive that there are structural problems in the market, take appropriate measures. It doesn't specify what the measures need to be, but it could be, for example, impose a data sharing obligation or impose a neutrality obligation so that these platforms treat everyone equally, or impose transparency obligations. Now, I'm not going to argue in favor or against of any of those, but the idea that when the problem is systemic, you can apply certain measures, and the brilliance of regulation is that you can customize it however you want. There is an underused regulatory concept which is called sunset clauses, which means come up with a regulatory measure, but make it automatically expire after 1 year or after certain conditions in the market have been met. And the brilliance behind it is that you say, look, regulation is not as inflexible as we're used to thinking. It's just a temporary tool. But instead of having to go company after company in separate investigations, I just need to impose that tool across the board. It might be a little crude, but if I plan it properly, if I design it properly, if I make it expire properly, it has the potential to solve these kind of like structural problems. And the second, one is these market investigations. And the second tool that the European Union has come up with is, again, explicit regulation. The so-called gatekeepers, however the European Union will define them, we don't know yet. The final details are going to be unveiled in December. So the so-called gatekeepers, they might incur additional obligations. And most likely these will have to be non-discriminatory obligation. So you can't really kick out an app out of your store because it competes with one of your own apps. Mm-hmm. I'm not taking a position as to whether this is like a good thing or a bad thing, and we need to carefully consider how to frame it. But I do think that it's a good idea that when everybody is doing the same thing in the market, then you need measures that apply to everybody.
Because I have a comment of Joanna, which and it is really joining what I wanted to say also. This is great. The thing is, if they do the same thing, but they could pretend they don't. It's not like, as Joanna is saying, airlines and GPS are both very much like big tech in what their natural size of market is in global. But the reason they are more than one airplane company and more than one GPS is a security decision to create artificial competition. I'm not sure right now that GAFA are really all competing with each other, because we could also say, Apple is selling phones, but me, Amazon, I don't, or maybe differently, or we don't have exactly the same share of the market, or we're not into social media network, and actually we're still all in the same ball, right? So it's interesting.
Can I make a final remark on this?
Please, please.
We would need a whole different session to answer the question of whether these companies compete against each other. And let me tell you, defining the market in which the investigation will take place and in which we will identify competitors is one of the most hotly contested areas. Because if you define it broadly, you have more competitors coming in. If you define it narrowly, it means that you might actually be a monopolist in that market. Quite interestingly, in the Android case in the European Union, the European Union defined the market in a way that Android does not compete with iOS. Now, to pretty much anyone who has ever owned a smartphone, it seems to me that they would think that Android and iOS are direct competitors. The reasons why they did it, it's not a completely absurd decision to not include it. And the reason why they did it is because Android is the only major operating system that can be licensed to other manufacturers, whereas Apple, the iOS system, is only open to Apple. Now, this is an okay consideration, but it means that you're looking at the market only from one constituency. Which one? The manufacturers of mobile phones, because in the eyes of the consumers, they are substitutable. It's only in the eyes of manufacturers of mobile phones that they're not substitutable. And even in the eyes of app developers, they are substitutable. So whether these companies compete with each other, it's a tricky thing. It partly relates to who we are looking at, but it also partly relates to time. And in one of the articles that that I wrote and you shared, which is the exclusion in digital markets article, which you shared in the chat, in the chat, I have a nice table towards the end that basically shows the product and service markets that these companies have entered over the past 20, 30 years. And what you will notice is that they've entered several markets. And whether they compete with each other, sometimes it's a matter of like just time. Just give them a couple of years and they will enter that that market. Now, is that a good way to think about it? That's what they're arguing. But in the very end, what matters is, do consumers, if we think that they are the ones that we care most about, have actual choice? And I'll finish with this. Even when we look at consumers, and even when Android and Apple are considered to be substitutable, that's not the end. Because what the commission found in different data, and what the US investigation found, is that most people are unlikely to switch between Android and iPhone. Once you're in an ecosystem, nobody forces you to stay in the ecosystem, but the market dynamics are such that it's very difficult to leave that ecosystem. So sure, they compete, but then again, do they really? And I'm just putting it out there. I don't want to take a position, but I'm sharing the kind of like considerations that can be thrown from both sides to show how difficult this kind of like debate is in determining who's right and who's wrong. And let me just, okay.
This is why you're a lawyer, right?
Sorry?
This is why you're a lawyer, otherwise.
No, exactly. Exactly. And this is why we work for one company one day and one company for the other day. But I mean, in a way, I take pride in this kind of like arrangement because, there is some truth in both sides. And the question is, you know, which truth is stronger at any given point, and which harm is the worst that you want to protect against? But let me just finish with one thing that goes back to an early point that I made, which is, do we protect consumers or do we protect the process of competition? Now, I would be all in favor of protecting consumers, because if you can get straight to the outcome, then great. Why do you care about the process? If the outcome looks okay, and that's, you know, that's what you're focusing on, then great. But the problem with focusing on consumers is that we often can't trust consumers because they're short-sighted. If I give you a cheap product today, you're gonna buy it, even if I tell you, but what if the competitors that are slightly more expensive disappear from the market, and then the only company that is left in the market jacks up the price? As a consumer, how likely are you to care about this? It's very hard for us to take like all the decisions in mind, that all the factors in mind, to decide what is best for the market. And think about this next time we think in, you know, as consumers, and we think as authorities, and we think as companies. Like, yeah.
Exactly. And you spoke about this difference between the UK and Europe and the US approaches because of that. And I was actually, I wanted to ask this very last question. Do you think that, I mean, actually, I know that we are six and I'm the chief time officer. And normally I should actually close the discussion, but I want to know in the chat, give me just a yes. Shall we have a couple of minutes more, please? Say just yes or make a wave or whatever in your reactions button. I'm going to gallery view and see that a lot of people, yes, okay, yeah, we have one, two, well, three, four people, can be five, yeah, well, give me more. Six, yes, seven, eight, okay, no, we're going on. This is wonderful. So let's go on just for a couple of minutes, okay? Thank you very much for your feedback. So this is an interactive session indeed. And I wanted to ask you, because of the difference between the US, you were mentioning, and Europe, do you think that competition law has a role in dealing with this problem? Is this something that competition law itself should address?
And by problem, you mean whether they are supposed to protect competitors or protect...
Because of the privacy problems that we have, that the consumers are maybe a little weak, and you say, oh, this is cheap, but you know, this product would be better, but it would be a little bit more expensive. But the consumer would say, like, well, why should I buy something more expensive? Because I can't afford it, and etc. So all these specific problems due to having this consumer approach to protect the consumer perspective. Do you think it is something that competition law should approach and take into account completely?
Well, In a way, the answer has to be yes. I mean, competition law can never be made effective unless it decides for itself what it sets out to achieve. Like, what is its raison d'être, since you're French? Sorry, I butchered it.
Yes. but I
should say that they almost never discuss it explicitly. Like, what are we supposed to be doing here? There are snippets here and there that say, we protect competitors, we protect competition, we protect consumers, and so on. I don't think that that competition law can very clearly say, I'm going to pick one goal and one goal only, and I'm always going to go with that. I don't think that this is true, because in different cases, you might need different theories of harm. You might have different types of evidence. You might have like different constituencies that are harmed. So to give you an example, in the Google shopping case in the European Union, the European Union never managed to prove harm to consumers. It kept saying that this has been harmful to consumers, but it never actually proved harm to consumers. Now, legally speaking, and in terms of legal standards, it didn't have to. All it had to prove is that the conduct could harm consumers, but not that in fact has harmed consumers. So it's very much concerned about consumers, but nowhere in the decision makes an effort to substantiate this particular claim. And this is a very big problem, because it undermines trust in the system. It undermines what competition law is supposed to be doing. It would be much better if it said, look, what Google did is that it harmed competitors. All of the comparison shopping websites went out of the market because of what Google was doing. And this is what we care about. But then that would shift emphasis of the case, not about what consumers, how consumers were harmed, but how competitors were harmed and why we should care about that. And it's quite interesting that in the US case now that was opened, I think last month, again against Google search, they said the following very interesting thing. They said that Google keeps saying that we have traditionally had a very large share of the market. Competition is one click away. The fact that consumers prefer to search with our search engine means that we are providing good results. And the Department of Justice said, we're not doubting that Google is good, but how do we know that we cannot have something better? How do we know that because of what Google is doing, Microsoft Bing could not now have been a better competitor? Now, this has a name. It's called the Nirvana fallacy. It means that you're complaining about something, not because it's bad, but because it's not better. And it's impossible to prove this hypothetical. It's impossible to say that if Google hadn't done this, then Microsoft would have been even better. And to me, this is very interesting, because in the US, this might be very difficult to fly as a theory of harm, because they generally don't think like that. And I think the Department of Justice slipped up there by saying that our theory of harm is a hypothetical. And I don't know how they're going to argue this in the end, but that was a bit of a slip up. But the reason why I'm concerned is because Google has, in a way, if this is how the Department of Justice frames it, it sets up Google for success. You know why? Because Google has all the data on its side to prove that you don't really need a lot of data to become a successful search engine. There is a lot of research in computer science that shows that going from 10 data points to 1,000 data points increases your results by this much. But going from 1,000 data points to 10,000 does not increase it as much. Going from 10,000 to 100,000 does not increase it as much. And this is called like diminishing marginal returns. Mm-hmm. And so Google has a very good way to argue that it's not the lack of data that Microsoft that prevents Microsoft from developing a good search engine. It's incompetence. And unfortunately, it's a very hard way for the Department of Justice to prove that the reason why they're bringing this case is because we could, in a utopia, have a better case. So to answer your question, it very much rests with competition law to decide what it seeks to achieve and pick the proper theory of harm and stick with it. They need to be able to say, whose harm I care about, how am I going to prove it? Here are the relevant data. And a lot of competition cases collapse, not because there is not something there. I don't claim that Google didn't do anything wrong in search or in Android, but the problem is that they focus on the protection of consumer, yet they never prove it. Mm-hmm. They focus on we could have had something better, but that's an impossible theory of harm to prove. And I think that these are kind of like strategic errors on the side of competition authorities, that if they had argued it differently, they would have had a better case and they would have protected consumers better. Can I end with one very minor point? Because yes. I still see that there are still 34 people in the room, as many as...
I know. This is great. We are super happy.
Extra time. I'll give you a concrete example of when I think that a competition authority did it properly. In the Microsoft case 20 years ago in the European Union, one of the concerns of the European Commission back then was that because of what Microsoft was doing, which was to tie Windows Media Player with Windows, it was driving other competitors from the market. And primarily it was... what was its name? Real Player. It was Real Player. Mm-hmm. I don't know if anyone remembers this. People around my age will remember Real Player. It was a good player. Now, to prove that that Microsoft, because of the tying, excluded competitors from the market, including Real Player, that was relatively easy. You just look at the percentage of these companies. But how do you prove that that was bad for consumers? So what the commission relied on back then is tests and rankings from popular PC and computer magazines back then that compared, and all of that was completely unrelated to the case. All of that preceded the case, but compared Windows Media Player to other media players, including Real Player. And the commission said, in most of those tests, it seems that Windows Media Player doesn't fare very well. So the fact that even though it is evidently not a better product, the fact that it seems to be getting so much traction while all the other competitors are driven out of the market, I can only attribute it to the fact that Windows is forcing it on consumers, and it's not really out of choice. And to me, this is a good example of following through, picking your theory of harm, proving your theory of harm. And I think these are strategic choices that competition authorities need to take more seriously. I'll end with this.
Yes, no, this is wonderful. I mean, we could go on with this discussion forever. I mean, I'm really starting to enjoy competition law, Konstantinos. I mean, you said you would take the challenge to involve me into this. And I'm like, yes, I love it. Actually, I feel like, yeah, this is really interesting. And Elena Malikova had also a note on your point.
Is more I can about see.
The, yes, okay. So yeah. About the burden of proof, not only about who is harmed. So this is also very interesting. There are a couple of things about pursuing the theory of harm. Okay, I'm so sorry, but I think we're ready to close.
A lot,
oh yeah. My God, and then we get even more fantastic.
Helena raises some very good points, including the burden of proof. And there are things to say about that as well. I know we ran out of time. It's great that we have had so much engagement. I know this is your role to say this, but I'm really happy that so many knowledgeable people are pushing back. And I think this is great because it shows that these people care about what is going on in the market and in competition law enforcement. So yeah, I mean,
Yeah, also
it
I
looks
see...
looks like lawyers are not going to go out of business anytime soon.
No. I'm sure. This is something with a bright future, I would say. No, I'm seeing also, and I engage people to have a look at the chat also. Johanna Nula is making also a note. I would argue cross-disciplinary and cross-sectoral debate is needed to understand what citizens, consumers, can or cannot do. I think it's really super interesting. I'm envisioning something. And Nanny, who is here, Nanny Jansen-Reventlow, who has been the initiator of this series, I should ask you, Nanny, maybe we should do something where we have two lawyers on stage. Imagine this. And I would be in the middle. I wouldn't even have the opportunity to ask a question, you know. We would give them a really difficult case and say right or wrong, you know. We should inquire into this. I mean, if people like the idea of having two lawyers on stage, please put it in the chat so that we know, do you like the idea? Would you like to come up on stage, you know? So just say something. You can say yes, 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 or no, no, no in the chat if you like. I think it would be really nice to see who would like to have a debate also and make this even more lively. And have not two answers after the discussion, but probably 100, as you said, Konstantinos. Thank you so much for this discussion. I mean, it was fascinating, really. And I mean, sometimes you think you say it's fascinating in a very, you know, this American way to say, oh, fascinating. I mean it. I really enjoyed it.
I'm really glad it was useful.
Yeah, totally. So thank you very much, Konstantinos.
Before you go, let me just say that I've also enjoyed it very much. The audience is fantastic. It is a testament to, you know, the kind of people that are attracted to what charities or NGOs like DFF are doing. And I'm happy that obscure topics like competition and antitrust law that basically 10 years ago were not even on the curricula of law schools are now gaining a little more traction.
Yes, exactly. No, I think so. And I think there is even more opportunities coming up. You said with blockchain and cryptocurrencies coming up, and I see more, I think much more is coming up. I mean, when you enter the sphere of virtual reality, mixed reality, collection of data, which is even more invasive in bodies and etc., it will go into the consumer actually. And then the role of having your own mind and your own, you know, decision to make. I saw in the chat already, Melissa said she changed her mind about what she's going to buy or something. I mean, somebody said also, I think it was Joanna, she's not buying on Amazon. I'm not buying on Amazon either. So anyway, however, thank you very much. It's great. Sure. And passionate speakers like you and Anif last week, also fantastic. Thank you to the ones we see less, like Charles, who has been setting all this, Melissa, who has been animating all the chat and pushing all the information. Save the chat before you leave, if you can. I mean, there are three dots. Save the chat so you can have all the sources we were talking about. This is really interesting. You have all the recommendations also of Konstantinos and the Digital Freedom Fund. So save it. And thank you to those who have been asking, commenting, Joanna, Elena, Johanna, wonderful. And I will see you next week. And next week, just to make a small preview, and I think she's here with us today, so this is great. Next week, we're going to go into the topic of Facebook's business model and see if Germany actually just outslow Facebook's business model. Is the case actually closed? We don't even know. So maybe we will dig into this together with Dr. Miriam Caroline Buiten. And she's an assistant professor of law and economics at the University of St. Gallen. We are traveling around with this series. And our main focuses are technology, information law, law and digitization, antitrust law. So we will dig into this further next week. Same time, same place, I do believe. Yes, exactly. Also 5 CET and 11 EST. Well, then I just have to say goodbye and see you next week. Yes. Bye.
Bye.